This is an ABC podcast.
Jess Hill says that people talk a lot about the danger of dark alleys. But the truth is that in every country in the world, the most dangerous place for a woman is in her home. Jess Hill is a journalist, and her groundbreaking, culture-shaking book about domestic violence that was called See What You Made Me Do was released in 2019. It won a brace of awards for plunging into the painful truth about the violence inflicted on women in Australia. And it also became the subject of an SBS documentary series. How to change that story of domestic abuse is a complicated business. But Jess Hill believes it must be done. And not just for the victims of domestic violence. She says it needs to be done for the perpetrators as well. And she thinks the real question is not, why does she put up with it? But why does he do it in the first place? And how do we get him to stop? Jess Hill has reported from the United States, and she's reported from Cairo in the aftermath of the Arab Spring. So she's seen a few false dawns in her time. And now she's written a new quarterly essay on the progress of the Me Too movement in Australia. And she's asking what gains have been made over the past 5 years. Hi, Jess.
Hi, Richard.
I'm going to begin by following your amazing twists and turns in journalism, which begin for you in high school. Tell me about your first foray into high-stakes journalism while you were still at high school.
Yeah, so I guess I was always going to be kind of self-made. And when I was 15, I decided I wanted to start a magazine. It was going to be an intelligent alternative to women's magazines. And in my head, it was a combination between Time magazine and Cosmopolitan. So you could have like the fashion and the stuff that women wanted, but we'd also cover the hard issues. And, you know, back then, and it shows just how far we've come since, like, what is it, 1997? Really, most people in Time were men. It was very clear to me as a teenager that those magazines spoke to men. They weren't speaking to women, and women were being told about blowjobs and high heels. You know, that was what we were supposed to be interested in. And I had always just considered myself a person. I really hadn't sort of identified with womanhood per se.
Not the kind of womanhood that was on the magazine racks.
No.
Anyway.
And right. I guess like now I might be seen as like, I might have grown up being genderqueer if I'd been born, you know, into this time. So I decided, yeah, I want to start this magazine. It's going to be a free magazine. It's going to be on the streets. And at that time, it was not offensive to ask people to write for free, apparently, especially people who were 15 or 16 years old. And so I started by like really mapping out how this magazine was going to look.
Well, hang on just a sec.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you can want to start a magazine like that. And when I hear you say that, I think, yes, you'll go through journalism. And maybe when you're 30 or 35, you'll start that magazine. But you wanted to start it right there and then when you were 15?
I didn't have time. You're studying.
Right.
And the person in my mind was Poppy King, who started her lipstick empire at 18. Mm. So for me, she made it possible. Like, I was like, yeah, I can do that. I didn't have any money. My parents didn't have any money. So I knew I'd have to raise money by selling advertising or sponsorship packages. But I actually started recruiting students to be writers. And so one of the first things I did was to make contact with some private schools. So I went to a public high school and I thought, you know, I'll go and tour some of the private schools thinking that maybe they've got some smarter people. That's how I thought back then, you know. And so I went to this private school and I spoke to their English class in my recruitment mode. And after that, they said, would you like to have a tour? And I said, oh, I'd love to see your music room, because I was a pianist and a budding singer. And I went to their music room and they had this grand piano and all of this equipment in this amazing room. And it was the first time I'd ever confronted the reality of class, and that we didn't have that. Like, literally, the piano at Barrenjoey High, which is not like from some down and out suburb, it's Avalon on the northern beaches of Sydney, you know, but we'd have keys missing. There were no batteries in the keyboard, in the, you know, electric keyboards. And it was just so confronting. And I think it was, funnily enough, it was a politicising moment.
What became of your magazine, your plans for your magazine to do
well,
that?
I left school. Okay, well, in between, I was a child actor and I was on Breakers, this, you know, poor man's version of sort of E Street or Home and Away, that filmed in Bondi. And I was away from school for months and months and months. I missed exams. I don't even know if I did my Year 11 exams. Anyway, my schooling was quite itinerant. I also went on this big like tour with my mum around the world for 3 months in Year 12. So like by the time I got to my HSC, I really was not very focused. And I actually smoked dope right before my maths exam, thinking it would relax me. And then I forgot what maths was. So I think I got less than 30. They don't even tell you how much you get when you get that. So my mark did not actually allow me to get into university. But my mum had always been like, don't worry about university, you'll make it work. And so I was determined, right, I'm going to start this magazine. So I went on a tour around Sydney and Melbourne, and I actually did sell like $40,000 worth of advertising for this magazine that didn't exist yet. And then this publisher came on board. It was the head of an advertising agency who really saw merit in what I was trying to do. And she was so excited about it. She gave me her corner office in Neutral Bay. She, you know, gave me access to her graphic designers. Like, I'm like 18 at this point.
So it was really happening at
this
point.
Oh, it was happening. Yeah, it was happening. And we had adult photographers and writers contributing their services for free. I would never ask people to do that now because the scene's very different.
And what was this mag called?
It was called Chic. Which was spelt phonetically, so S-H-E-E-K.
Right.
It was just something that had come to me like in a flash, and I hadn't thought much about the title, and it just stuck. And so we got to really the very edge of launching this thing. And basically I had come back into contact with a long-lost third cousin who I had really become very close with, who had revealed that he had terminal cancer not long after us getting back in touch. And early on in us getting to know each other, my publisher met him and they fell in love. And like, this guy was not the sort of guy I expected my publisher to fall in love with. Like, you know, not to fat shame or fat phobia, but he was pretty grossly obese. Like, you know, the chemistry between them was organic and raw and amazing. But long story short, we discovered that he was actually a pathological liar and had never had cancer. Or he had cancer a long time ago but did not have cancer at the time that we knew him, and had faked having, like, you know, needles in his arm. And I dropped him off at hospital appointments that he'd just gone on a walk around the block and come back. And the kicker was that he had told my publisher that he was sterile due to the treatment, and then she fell pregnant to him.
So what effect did this have on your plans? What effect did that have on the plans to launch this magazine?
Pretty destructive, because essentially my publisher like went AWOL, understandably, just trying to figure out what the hell am I going to do. She'd always wanted to get pregnant. You know, she wanted to keep the baby. And so the effect of that was that her clients, who were bankrolling, you know, the agency and the magazine, started to get a bit like, what's going on? And the chief financial officer pulled me into the office one day and said, I'm sorry, the situation has changed and we just don't have the budget to fund you. We're not going to be able to go ahead with it.
And did this guy ever tell you why he'd spun this whole pack of lies?
No, I never actually spoke to him about it. He came to our house after he'd been exposed, and my mum was very forthright with him that he should never darken our door again, and then he disappeared.
So the whole thing is this terrible debacle, but you would have learned a lot in that process of trying to launch a rocket, even if it does sort of explode on the podium. Now, you know, and it wasn't your fault either. You would have learned a lot of that. Your next job after that was working in, after a stint in advertising, you were named as the editor of a fancy travel magazine. Now, is that as good a job as it sounds, to be the editor of a fancy high-end travel mag?
Yes. Yes, it is. And the way that I ended up getting that, I was pretty much on Skid Row, like on Centrelink, and I was with a man who was much older than me, about 14 years older. He wanted to live in Elizabeth Bay on the water, and I could not afford that on the dole. And so I was just like looking at Seek every 2 minutes, just like refresh, refresh, refresh. And this travel advertorial job came up, and I was just like, I am totally unqualified to do any type of writing. Like, I'm just, all I've done is try to start my own failed business at this stage, or, you know, been an account coordinator at an agency. But I just sort of went with as much chutzpah as I could manage. And apparently I was the first person to apply, and that's the reason I got the job.
So what did that mean?
So it meant that I was at first just writing advertorials for like travel operators, but then I ended up getting promoted, and so I was like going on these ridiculous junkets with some of the most legendary travel writers, like Susan Kurosawa at The Australian. We went to some like Central West luxurious retreat. I went to Paris and reviewed all the palace hotels. They're the ones that don't have a star rating because they're right at the top. 23 years old doing this. I went on the most luxurious junkets because I was travel writing for a businesswoman's magazine.
When you do that, does it feel really good, or do you sort of feel like you're impersonating something or other, or you're how does it feel when you're that person who's being put up for free? Well, apparently for free in these extraordinary places.
So pretty great. Great. And you know, at 22 years old, like, you're just pretty much taking what you can get and thinking what a amazing life I seem to be living. But having said that, for me, it was always about the quality of the writing. So my hero as a travel writer was Jan Morris, who was able to eke out of the tiniest little detail the entire world, you know. And so I used these opportunities as much as I could to build my writing skills and to learn how to be a writer, because I thought a lot of people just phone in travel writing. It's pretty crap a lot of the time, but I was determined that mine would have this narrative. But it got to the point where, yeah, when I went to review the Club Med in Mauritius, flying first class, I arrived at this island that was clearly in flux, where there were signs right outside the airport, one about poverty and homelessness and the other about AIDS. And I learned pretty quickly that, you know, this island has got the highest density of five-star resorts in the world. I thought, that's got to do something pretty weird to a place. And so I started asking questions and started interviewing the staff on their time off, and usually after we'd had a few drinks, and really just started discovering this whole thing about how Mauritius had gone from a sugarcane economy to one that was all about like telecommunications and luxury tourism, and what effect that it had on the populace and on the people who were working at the Club Med, who of course weren't allowed out of their bedrooms, you know, when they weren't working, had to hand back their shoes at the end of the contract. And for me, I was just like, I could just stay at this very nice place on the edge of the Indian Ocean and drink cocktails and do yoga, or I could find out what's really going on here. And I did the latter. And I got on a bus, went to a homeless shelter in town. I just found out, it was a fascinating story. And on the plane on the way back, it's when it clicked. I was like, I'm not a travel writer. Like, I'm just not cut out for this, and I'm not going to get away with writing articles like this for many other people who pay thousands to send me to their resorts.
Did you write the story anyway?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And did they publish it?
Yeah, they did. But on that plane ride back, I decided to make myself into a journalist. And I didn't have a typical pathway. I hadn't gone to university. I probably wasn't going to get a cadetship. So I just decided, well, there's this really important election coming up in the States. It was 2007 at that point. What if I just got a blog? If I could just blog every 2 or 3 days, I'll earn a pittance, but I can tax deduct the trip. And so that way I'll probably make back the airfare. Or so, I don't know. I don't even know if I knew how tax deductions worked, but I thought you could probably just claim it all back.
It's probably best not to think that through too much, because you'd never do a damn thing otherwise, would you?
No. And I ended up in $10,000 debt anyway, but it wasn't important to me how it happened. I just knew that I had to take this opportunity, go overseas and just do something with myself and craft some kind of journalism career.
That was such a pivotal election in the United States. In the course of that election process, I think in 2007, it was Barack Obama versus Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination. John McCain eventually got it for the Republicans, but then the world tipped into the global financial crisis.
The day that I left Australia, literally George Bush was announcing on television the global financial crisis, and the dollar, which had been at $1.10, went to, I think, 53 cents within about 2 or 3 weeks. I can't remember, like, you know, but it was a very short period of time. and just pretty much lit all my money on fire. And not to mention that, but all of the planning that I'd done for the election issues we were going to cover and the classic sort of perennial American election issues became totally irrelevant. So we had to really operate on the hop because now we were covering the emerging global financial crisis. So I went to places like the foreclosure capital of the United States in Stockton, just outside of San Francisco, and saw the neighborhoods that were all for sale and where the, you know, the grass out the front was going brown and dying because literally the whole place had been evacuated. And I remember my partner and I, who was with me doing the writing, we went to a Starbucks and we thought, we'll just ask the first person we see if they've lost their house and just see how prevalent this is. And the first person we saw was the woman behind the counter. And we said, you know, did you lose a house? And she said, yeah, I lost two. Like, she was working at Starbucks for minimum wage. She'd bought two houses during, you know, George Bush's presidency. And that just was writ large across the United States.
So back in Australia, you got a job with AM, the ABC radio program, wonderful AM, real fast, high turnaround, get up at 4:30 in the morning. What was the work like? How did you enjoy it?
Well, I was a transcriber, so I started at the very bottom. So I sort of just went all the way back. I got a bit of an in from a friend who was like, they need transcribers at this very early hour of the morning. And I was just, I wanted any way in to the ABC I could get. And to be honest, like starting as a transcriber, I would listen to, you know, politicians on slow-mo, rewind, correct. You know, I would hear them in my ears in a way that is very different to how you normally listen. And that close listening of politicians was a real teachable moment for me. I learnt a lot about their cadences, about what they do or don't say. And then I decided I couldn't be a transcriber forever, ever. I love typing. I can touch type. You know, it was actually quite a lot of fun, but I did want to do more. And so I decided I just wanted to show as much initiative as I possibly could and ended up getting appointed as a researcher. And that's when I started working with PM and The World Today. And, you know, just working under the wing of legendary people like Mark Colvin, Edmund Roy, Eleanor Hall. These people who, it was such a genuine mentoring process that just feels so lucky to have. A lot of young journalists coming up don't have that opportunity. And it's only like, it's not that long ago. It's like 10 years ago, but it's a really different world even here at the ABC now.
I really miss Mark. I wish he was still here so much. Mm. Working in that environment with people like Mark, you covered the, what was known as the Arab Spring, the uprisings in Arabic speaking countries across North Africa and in the Middle East. And Twitter was a really important part of that. It was an important part of Mark's life as well. Tell me about that time and how that sort of one thing fed into another and how Mark might have taught you something, but you might have taught him something too.
So Mark had really started using Twitter during the Iran uprisings in 2009, which is sort of when Twitter kind of came into its own as like, this is...
Oh, yes, the good Twitter years.
The good Twitter years, the liberating years where Twitter was going to liberate us all and it was going to connect the common man with the megaphone, you know, and give voice to the voiceless, et cetera, et cetera. And it did. So he was already very much onto Twitter. I wasn't. Like, you know, I signed up for an account in 2010 and was very nervous about it. Like, just don't put anything that you think online. But when it was about February of 2011, my colleague Connie Aegis had been like right across the Egyptian uprising. She saw what was coming and she could see how important this was. I took longer to come to it, but she started using Twitter in much the same way Mark had, and which was basically just to say, like, to look out across what was being tweeted, try to find sources that seemed reliable and to contact them privately and see if they would speak to us. And I guess over the next 10 or 11 months, as we went from, so it was Tunisia to Egypt to Libya, Bahrain and beyond, all across the Middle East, you had these uprisings. We kind of turned it into an art form where we developed this network of probably about 300 contacts from political families, like the sons of politicians, through to people who were leading the protest movements. And we were managing those, like that network of contacts from the Sydney newsroom, like 18 hours a day, and keeping on top of what was happening from hour to hour. And so we had these incredible stories. Like, we were actually like Reuters reporting news as it happened and having people come on the line who were in a square, like in Bahrain, the Bahraini photographer who spoke to Mark, who was reporting from the moment when the Saudis were crossing the bridge into Bahrain to suppress the protests. We can hear the gunshots in the background. And what was astonishing, particularly about Mark's involvement with this, was that he was able to take people who were going through an absolute peak moment where their lives were literally in danger at the very moment that they were speaking to him, and take them through it calmly and get out of them the best of what they had to say. You know, and I remember one, I think it was at the end of that interview, he said, like, what is it that you're trying to achieve here? And he said, we are fighting for our rights, our human rights. And there was this sense of immediacy and hearing it from the mouths of the people who were laying their lives down to achieve this change. I just could not allow the Arab uprisings to be reported on via the lens of Western academics. That was like a no-no. And it had to have this sort of visceral sense. For me, it was like, I want listeners, next time they meet someone from that region, to have like a visceral sense of who those people are and what they want, why they're doing what seems unthinkable, laying their lives down in front of like guns and soldiers just for the right to vote. And that was it was an electric time in the office. God bless AMPM and the world today. They ran with it. We reported every day. It was such a blow by blow kind of account. And then at the end of that, I actually got a fellowship, the Edward Murrow Fellowship, to go to the States. And so I got to go back to the States right at the time that the Occupy Wall Street movement was exploding. And the minute we touched down, like in Washington, the parks were occupied, the streets were occupied. Every city we went to, I think we went to 5 different cities, there was a protest going on. And they were directly linking back to the Arab uprisings. In fact, there was communication between the two movements about how to have a non-violent movement. And so then becoming sort of really involved in that and coming back to Australia thinking that, you know, my whole mission was to continue to work with Radio Current Affairs, particularly to continue working with Mark and Edmund Roy, who were both very strong mentors and friends for me. And then got a phone call one Friday night, completely out of the blue, from Monica Attard, who I hadn't known. I had lionized for her, you know, former correspondent role in Russia. She was a hero to me, but I didn't know her. And she just said to me, like, do you like working at the ABC? And I'm like, I love working at the ABC. And I'd actually got a permanent job, so like no one leaves that. And she said, how would you feel about maybe becoming a Middle East correspondent? I was like, huh, okay. Well, that's a very interesting offer.
A Middle East correspondent where?
Well, it was going to be based in Beirut. But as things turned out, I chose to start in Cairo because that's where things were really happening at that time.
And what happened when you told your mum you were going to Cairo to become a foreign correspondent?
Yeah, she fainted.
She literally fainted?
She literally fell over. Yeah. And
poor mum.
And I think it was just so incomprehensible. Like, you think about from the point of view of Australia, the Middle East is like on fire, right? Like there's uprisings all across every country. It looks like Syria is heading into civil war. Like, it's not probably where you want to send your daughter, especially one who doesn't have any experience, like, in this on-the-ground type of reporting, aside from this, you know, various bits and pieces I created for myself. So I understand that response. But the funny thing was, when Monica asked me, like, I was about to go on a holiday to the Middle East, I was going to go and meet all, like, the contacts that we'd made during the uprisings. So I had this whole tour planned, and she was like, okay, so I'm going to need you to move in about 5 or 6 days.
Oh, right.
So I had to go to management at ABC and go, yeah, so I quit, but I quit now. Like, I actually cannot even stay another day. And they were very understanding and gorgeous about it. And I didn't even have time to pack up our apartment. My partner had to do that and I was gone.
So then you were filing stories from Cairo. Had you had any health issues up until that point? Had you had any headaches? Had you been noticing anything untoward?
No, nothing.
Nothing at all?
No.
So where were you when you had your first seizure?
I was on a plane and I was on my way back from Yemen to Beirut. We'd been in the Middle East for about 9 or 10 months. And finally, actually, just before I left to go to Yemen, I'd had, like, my back had gone out really badly. I had screwed up the whole visa thing, and they actually, Beirut security hadn't let me out of the country, and it was all very tense. And it felt like there was all this portent before the seizure. Like
the world was out of whack or something.
Yeah, yeah. Something. It was like there was there was a breach in the time-space continuum. Mm. And so I was on the plane coming back on my own, and I felt this, it was quite sudden. And what I can remember now is a feeling of my mind opening up like a trapdoor, and it was like language and concepts fell through it, and what was left was just darkness. And I felt myself internally fumbling around in that darkness, trying to grasp back some form of identity. This is all happening in milliseconds. And then I started to feel my head start jerking to the left, and it was jerking with this force, like it was totally, I couldn't restrain it. And I was sitting on the window, and so it was like I was banging into the side. And then the language came back. It's like it sort of like came back in this rush, and it was like I'm having a seizure, and I feel like I'm going to die.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, head to abc.net.au/conversations.
So you were telling me, Jess, that you'd had no indication of ill health. You were on a plane working as a Middle East correspondent at the time, and you were suddenly overwhelmed by this terrible seizure. Was there someone sitting next to you to say help to? What did you do?
Yeah, well, this guy was very engrossed in his iPad, and he was a couple of seats over, and he just hadn't noticed. Like, I hadn't noticed what was going on.
And what were you doing at the time? Were you still
I was
twitching and
totally
banging,
trapped inside my own body. And, yeah, my head was banging the side of the plane. But I managed to just summon this strength and mobility and threw myself onto this guy's lap. And then I can remember this so strongly. I felt with that human contact, I was safe, and it was safe for me to lose consciousness. That's how it felt. I mean, that's not probably how your body works. Maybe it is.
Maybe it is. There's always something pragmatic at work.
But it felt like I needed to lose consciousness. I couldn't cope anymore with what was happening. And what's extremely unusual, because this is what people call a tonic-clonic seizure, some people call it a grand mal, most people do not remember what happens before they go unconscious. And so this is part of the I made sure that I wrote it down very detailed afterwards. I've blogged about it. I've made documentaries about it, primarily to give people who have gone through those experiences and their loved ones a bit of a sense of what happens. I mean, you know, only what happened to me, but that feeling of going through that.
So this had happened on a plane.
Mm.
Where were you when you regained consciousness?
So I was sitting in the seat just next to where I'd been sitting, and I asked the stewardess, I needed to go to the bathroom. I don't know why I asked, because I had no memory at that time that I'd had a seizure. I just woke up and suddenly, like, you know, there I am, I'm conscious. And I got up to go to the bathroom and my legs buckled underneath me, and I was thinking, this is bad. And then they helped me back to my seat, and I looked to the seat next to me, and there was a wet patch. So obviously I'd wet myself during the seizure. And these people were being really nice to me. No one was telling me what had happened. And so, the woman in front of me gave me this bracelet saying, I hope you have a good time in Beirut. People were being so nice. Wow. I'm like, what is going on? And then at the end, when we landed, that's when they had told me what had happened. And this guy came and, you know, someone from the airport came to put me in a wheelchair to wheel me out to the cab. and got to the camp, and this guy like tried to charge me money for pushing me in the wheelchair, and I was like, I'm not paying you anything.
Sorry, not the ambulance, the cab.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Right.
And got into the cab, got back to, you know, where I was living in Jamaica.
What? You're not going to a hospital straight away?
No, I wasn't really with it. Like, I didn't know what had happened. I was very confused. And the most annoying thing for me at that time was that that guy at the airport had charged the cab driver what he wanted me to pay. And so now that cab driver was demanding that I pay him. So that was much more important to me at that time than the seizure I just had.
So what happened after that?
I got home and I'm pretty sure my partner David was there. This is much patchier a memory than the actual seizure, which is so strange. But essentially we thought, look, it's probably going to be okay. We were living right next to the Red Cross. So these guys used to like smoke just outside our balcony. They came up and checked me and they said, look, you probably should go to hospital, but why don't you just rest? Because I'd been up all night.
So when did you finally get to a hospital?
Well, I started having rolling seizures, right? So it was clear that I was not okay. Went up the road to the hospital. They did a scan and they said to me, there's something on your brain. We're just not sure what it is. We'll have the results in about 24 hours. So they kept me in a hospital bed. And during that 24 hours, myself and my partner, David, like it could be anything from you have a terminal tumor and you've got a day to live through to it could be a benign cyst. And we had no clue. And I remember just laying in that bed with David, holding his hand and just being awake as the sun was rising and just looking out and just going, for all I know, this could be my last day on earth. And we just had to wait and see. And it was I think because of just the discombobulating nature of it, it was just quite transcendent. I wasn't deeply scared, but that would come later.
Life felt sweet just for a little while.
Mm.
So what was it then?
Well, at first they told me when they got the results, it's a benign cyst. And luckily I had work insurance that included both kidnap, ransom and hostage and also brain surgery. So they put me up in this amazing, you know, John Hopkins University Hospital in Beirut where all the sheikhs go to get their treatment. Had a self-playing grand piano in the reception. Like, it was ridiculous, the luxury of the whole thing. I got operated on by one of the world's leading neurosurgeons. And the whole experience was actually really beautiful. And I came to it thinking, actually, this is just a benign cyst. They'll cut it out. That'll be the end of it for me. And I will just continue on being a Middle East correspondent. What they didn't tell me so much was that it wasn't a cyst. They told me this at the airport as I was about to go home for Christmas holidays. I said, so it's not a cyst. It's actually a tumor. And we think it's a... And then the phone dropped out because my prepaid phone had just run out of credit. And then by the time I was able to get back in touch with the surgeon, he'd gone home for the day. So I didn't know what it was. I was just like, right. Yeah. So it wasn't until right. I can't remember. It was like a couple of days later, we were able to like get a clear sense of what it was. But really not until we got back to Australia and they were able to give it like a biopsy of the tumour that they said, okay, it's a grade 2. I think it was an astrocytoma. There were so many different words that flew around. But it was on the borderline of we would consider that cancerous or not. But so in between, it was going to be something I'd have to manage for the rest of my life. You never get remission from brain cancer. It could come back at any time. And even as early as a few weeks ago, my neurosurgeon, neuro-oncologist team were talking about, well, we've seen some regrowth and it's a little bit concerning. We might have to go in and operate and do radio and chemo like next year. But now they've sort of like stepped that back a bit. I don't know what the hell is going on because it's all subjective. The thing with a tumour like mine and one that ostensibly has been taken out, as far as a neurosurgeon's concerned, they take it all out. A neuro-oncologist is like, oh yeah, right, you took out all the cells, did you? You actually can't do that, so don't say that you took it all out. So those cells, if they make more mistakes, it can, in a reasonably short period of time, kind of explode in my brain. What we see at the moment is it's probably growing very slowly, just like it did before we found it.
So this is a thing that was very likely been going. That's something been going on for years.
Could have been there for a decade. Could have been there for more. No idea, and no idea what causes it.
Back in Australia, you made the decision to launch a journalistic investigation into domestic violence, abuse of women in Australia. What led you into that very dark, dark place? And did you sort of take a deep breath before going into it?
I wish I'd had the presence of mind to do that. But actually, it came off the back of a feature in the monthly on electricity prices and the gold plating of the poles and wires. And that was the first feature I'd done for the monthly. And then Nick Fike, the editor, just commissioned me to write about domestic violence. And I don't know, I've never asked him, but I sort of sensed that maybe he thought I had a particular knack at making complex issues accessible. So I sort of came to it with that sensibility. Like, here's a complex issue that I don't understand and other people seem to not understand. So how am I going to break this down and make it simple? So that's where I came from.
Were you coming to it as a complete outsider? Had you ever had experience of
being
belted around yourself at all?
Never. And I thought I didn't know anyone who had. And I can tell you 7 years later, it's a smaller number of people who haven't in my close friends and family than who have, which I think tells us a lot about how prevalent we think this is or isn't in our immediate environment. But one of the first articles I wrote about this about a year into the investigation was everything I thought I knew about domestic abuse was wrong. And that's because when I started to understand it as primarily a phenomenon of power and control rather than primarily a phenomenon of violence, it upended so many preconceptions I had about who does it, who gets subjected to it, how it works. I'd never given it a lot of thought, but my basic knee-jerk thoughts about it were wrong.
How much of this stems from an idea that a man might have that he owns another woman, therefore, and owns what she does, and therefore, if she tries to leave, then that's theft because she's stealing herself. How much of it have you found that stems from that? That would you even call it a thought, but a certain way of thinking that a certain kind of man has?
So some men think that quite consciously, you know, and it's and they
you're
identify.
Mine. And I'll say that you're
yeah,
mine.
Yeah, you're mine, and right. I have the right to have sex with you, that's something that you consent to on our wedding day, though clearly marital rape legislation made that illegal a long time ago. You know, but they will definitely identify strongly with that idea, and not so much that they own them, but that it is the natural thing for a man to be in control in the relationship, to be the dominant partner. And that is just actually the best way for an intimate relationship to exist. Others, it is a sense of overblown entitlement that they probably wouldn't even be aware that they had.
So in that guy's mind, it doesn't matter if he does it. What's important is that he puts it out there that it's wrong to do it.
Yeah, and I've seen men, like I've looked at over the last few years, men who've committed homicide and looked at some of the last things they said in the days before on their Facebook profiles or whatever. One man in a particularly disturbing instance actually posted an article about my book about 2 or 3 days before he killed his partner. Another man said, like, the day you raise your hand to your partner is the day you stop being a man, and then killed his wife and her children. So it's complex, you know, this feeling of an almost pathological, which I use advisedly, not disordered, but in a way unrecognizable kind of feeling of entitlement to most normal people, you know, that like we think that we've got past that's something that was like in the 19th century, early 20th century, that feminism largely made that a relic of history. But what happens in these relationships is it's actually like this recreation of patriarchy, of an old world type of patriarchy in miniature in these households, in which that old natural order is recreated and the logic of it is reinstated in the minds of the person being subjected to it.
So a man who thinks that way, for him, is violence something to be enjoyed by him, or is it just like a tool in the toolbox? So in his mind, some unpleasant thing but necessary thing, or is it something that's enjoyed by that man?
You'd get 1,000 different answers from 1,000 different men. Some guys would be quite sadistic and enjoy the violence that they perpetrate and do it almost artfully. Others would be mortified by their use of physical violence, would apologise abjectly and then turn around and do the same thing again. Because I've spoken to guys who say they feel like they black out at the moment of using physical violence, but they were quite.
Do you believe that?
I don't see that that person is dissembling in front of me. I can imagine them getting flooded, but still maintaining a modicum of control. Like, I maintained a modicum of control when I had that seizure and threw myself over that guy's lap. I was out of control as one human being can be, but I was still in control of what I chose to do. So it's a very vexed subject, this whole idea of choice and what men like think about the violence that they're using. For a lot of guys who are the most dangerous, violence is not used at all, or it is used very sparingly. And they would, in fact, look at a man who uses physical violence and see them as a thug. But in their personal relationship, they would create a system of coercion and control that is so oppressive that they are basically reducing their partner to a shadow of themselves, to the point where some of these women end up being institutionalized. They are made to feel so insane.
And that's done through money and surveillance, by and large?
Surveillance, well, there's, you know, coercive control, which is a topic that I've sort of really zoned in on, which is essentially the vast majority of domestic abuse suffered by women who seek help, or men or women in same-sex relationships, and a small number of men in heterosexual relationships, that there's a plot line that unfolds in coercive control relationships that is so predictable that you can see it unfolding in one relationship to the next, slightly different details. It's like rom-coms, right?
Yeah.
Starts with you're more special than anyone else in the world. That's often the beginning. And then it unfolds into isolation, into degrading comments, into micromanagement of activities, into surveillance, into things like text messaging relentlessly so you feel like you're always under a gaze, into threats, degradation, or that thing that we understood to be true between us for years, I'm just now going to deny that as though it never was true and it never happened. Or our child, who you can see in front of us, has breathing problems. They don't have breathing problems.
Right.
And I'm going to cancel the private insurance. I'm going to turn off their breathing monitor. They don't have breathing problems. And literally, that is a real life story.
So what this man's looking for, and it is mostly men, is looking for a thrall, in other words.
It's a type of dominance that is designed to be invisible.
And these men, typically, how are they outside of that relationship? Do they tend to be the boss, or are they themselves a put upon schlub in the workplace?
Every type. I kind of like talk about there's two main patterns that we see in perpetrators, and one perpetrator may exhibit one pattern in one relationship and another pattern in another. So they're not categories of people, but you have a pattern that you see where these men are quite well put together. They are not really attached to the person they're with, but they really want someone to control, and they look for someone to control. So they will have a type that they go for. Could be someone who's grown up in an abusive household. It could be a nurse who's going to put their needs before their own. Could be an A-type personality that they will take great pleasure in breaking. But they will do it quite strategically and connivingly and consciously.
Right, so there's no one type.
No,
there's a modus operandi, but that's generally consistent, but there's no one type.
No, and that's right. A minority. I think a lot of people think of perpetrators as that. Like, they sort of see them as strategic and cunning and, you know. But actually, the vast majority of guys who end up perpetrating coercive control are dependent, morbidly paranoid, and desperately afraid that their partner will learn just what a piece of shit they are and leave them, or worse, disrespect them by hooking up with someone else. So they control the perimeter because they cannot be out of control in their personal lives. And that can be because they grew up in an environment where they were controlled, and they decided never to be controlled again. They will be the one in control.
So, Jess, you obviously have been talking to a whole lot of people who deal with this, who help women and families on a day-to-day basis with this stuff. What do they see as a necessary step forward? Let's just take it for granted we need better exits for women and better routes out of these situations, and however that can be supported through shelters, that can absolutely be done. But what other suggestions are there to focus on the perpetrator?
So there are lots of different approaches to this, but I think primarily, and I think this is, you know, this speaks very closely to what Me Too has spoken to, is that accountability is necessary to prevent future violence or future, you know, controlling situations. Once you have accountability, then men know they can't act with impunity. So that's why I've been quite strong in advocating for coercive control to be criminalised. And when I say coercive control to be criminalised, what I'm meaning is actually domestic abuse to be criminalised instead of just one-off physical incidents or destruction of property. I think we need to be seeing accountability for that system of abuse in order to start sending a prevention message. But the like in terms of actually reaching these guys, certainly you need to reach guys who are abusing right now to stop them moving on to the next partner and the next, you know, lot of kids. And there's everything from much longer and more intense programs that have got more of an evidence base to them. 32 weeks is kind of the minimum in the UK, through to residential places where men actually spend 3 months or more living in the space where they're undergoing this constant therapy, through to programs that go for 2 years, like the Caledonian model, that basically takes a one-on-one counselling situation, then moves it into a group, and then out to one-on-one, and then has mentorship, kind of like AA. So he needs someone to keep him honest, you know, and keep him in that place of clarity that he may have achieved in that program.
Into his sense of honour too.
Yeah, exactly, in a way that does not require him to exact his honour on his partner.
Yeah.
But I guess a lot of this work that we're sort of seeing when we're looking in the long range is we need to get to boys when they're young, you know, and we need to build shame resilience. We need to challenge this societal-wide contempt for women that is drummed into boys from the age that they're like 3 or 4, contempt for girls, contempt for girly things. Like, being a boy means not being a girl.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And that is slightly changing because of all this like genderqueer, non-binary stuff happening with a lot of the younger people now. I sound so old, the younger people. But it's such an invisible underlying part of our culture that we don't even notice it. We don't notice that the feminine is held in contempt because it's just an isness. You know, it's just an isness that, generally speaking, the feminine is devalued. Like, volunteer work, compassion, empathy, all that sort of stuff is given far less value than authority, autonomy, logic, rationality, strength, power. That's what we value in our society. We might say we value compassion and volunteerism and we give them like Australian of the Year or something, but they're not the ones earning the big bucks, right? So if you're a boy growing up and you're looking at who's got the hot girlfriend or even the hot boyfriend, but, you know, who's got the kick-ass job, it's the guy who's willing to do anything to get there, the guy who's most able to turn a no into a yes, the guy who's going to coerce anyone to give them what he wants and what he deserves. And that as a man and as a boy growing into a man, you're entitled to that position of power. That's what your entitlement is. And it's sort of the bargain that boys strike totally unconsciously that, okay, I'm gonna be that logical, strong, autonomous person who's not going to really be emotionally expressive and I'm not going to cry and I'm going to be strong. But the payoff is that I'm going to be entitled to a position of power. I'm going to be entitled to be in a powerful position in our society. And that's, none of that is front of mind. It's not anywhere in your frontal cortex. It's just an understanding that emerges.
Maybe. I think that's largely true. I also think there are plenty of boys who hear that kind of conversation. We need to change boys. We need boys to be different. And what they often hear and what they say they hear, particularly with phrases like toxic masculinity floating around, is that, oh, can't you just be more like a girl? And I don't, and they don't want to be like a girl. They don't feel like they're a girl and they can't talk in ways that are any way near as sophisticated as girls can. And so they sort of want to withdraw or even act up. Hence this kind of, what we see is often a lot of really crappy, petulant male behaviour.
And backlash. And of course, I'm massively generalising because we're talking about sort of like just a broad societal, cultural, you know, norms. But when you sort of use terms like toxic masculinity, it says to boys that you are toxic, that men are toxic. Mm. They can't help being toxic. It's just like it's bred into them. And very few people are showing them like positive pathways or like, oh, how do you actually be a boy in the world in a way that's not going to end up getting you beaten up and getting you punished by your milieu, like being like a girl might, but is going to be positive. And you know the people who do provide them with that positive role modeling? For a lot of boys, it's people like Jordan Peterson. It's podcast host Joe Rogan.
It's not their fathers?
It might be their fathers.
Who may or may not be around.
It may be their fathers, or it very much may not be. I mean, boys will have all sorts of different heroes. You know, they may have a really great sporting hero. It might be Adam Goods. I mean, they might have really great heroes. But I guess what I mean is, from in that gendered space where people are talking about masculinity, the sorts of people that are gaining the biggest followings in that regard are men who have open contempt for feminism and men who see the natural order of patriarchy as something that needs to be defended, that it has endowed us with thousands of years of civilization. It's the making of the Western world, and feminism, which seeks to undo it, or, you know, it's in its more boisterous times, smash it, is a threat to civilization.
I think ultimately feminism is a truly radical thing, and it's overturning what has been in place very unfairly since the year dot. I mean, you can find the odd scattering of evidence for matriarchal societies here and there. What it amounts to, though, if women are to be truly equal, it's a zero-sum game power. Men will have to resign power for women to take up that space. Maybe men don't really understand that. Maybe that's the thing, that there will have to be a resignation of power, or more consent required for a whole bunch of things where men have just waded in and taken what they felt like.
Oh, I think actually men do understand that, and that's a big part of why there's a backlash. And especially if you don't really give them a sense of what they're going to gain. All there is loss. That's what comes across to a lot of men. And, you know, it's funny, the whole thing around patriarchy, matriarchy, for me, it's not whether men or women were in charge. It's about, do you have societies that value power over or power with? And many Indigenous societies, including the ones in our own country, had interdependent relationships between men and women that valued the health and safety of the group over just the success of the individual. And the problem with our society is not so much male-dominated, it's the idea that you have the right to have power over.
Here's the offering, though, I think, for men, which is that you live a more honourable life.
You live a more emotionally embodied life where you're not expected to cut off the emotional side of yourself like a gangrenous arm and sequester it into some, you know, cryo chamber and be a strong, autonomous person, as though we don't need other people and as though we don't feel vulnerable ever. There's a psychologist in the that I quote in the quarterly essay who says, we raise boys and we say, if you're emotional, then you're not a real man. If you're relational, so if you are dependent on other people, you're not a real man. And then we wonder why some men grow up and act crazy, because we are literally saying to them, if you want to be a full human, you are not a real man. So, and then we cut off half their humanity from a very young age. We give them enough messages to say it is not safe for you to express your full humanity. And then some of them act inhumanely. Big surprise.
It's been completely amazing speaking with you, Jess. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
Jess Hill is the author of See What You Made Me Do and the brand new quarterly essay called The Reckoning. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.